Hello and welcome to Securing Sexuality, the podcast where we discuss the intersection of intimacy
and information security. I'm Wolf Gorlick.
He's a hacker. And I'm Stephanie Gorlick.
She's a sex therapist. And together we're going to discuss what safe sex looks like in a digital age. There's a question you always ask me, Stephanie, that I don't have a good answer for.
I mean, I ask many of those questions, but which one are you thinking of?
Well, I think I have a good answer for some of them. But you've often been like, what about GDPR? What about other privacy regulations? How does that impact pornography? And then you'll go and you'll be like, and you know pornography is a $35 billion industry annually. And I'll be like deer in the headlights.
I mean, I do like to spout random pornography fun facts. That's what happens when you marry a sex therapist. But yeah, I mean, this is something that I'm curious about because, you know, as a therapist, I'm based in the U.S., and I'm licensed in 4 states. And even in one country, the rules and regulations and reporting requirements and records retentions, all of that varies from state to state that I'm licensed in. And I have a lot of friends that are practicing in the EU. Hi, Silva, if you're listening. Hi, Jim. But, you know, it makes me curious if it's so different from state to state within one country, what does it look like for my EU peers or, you know, people practicing around the world. I have a supervisee who travels everywhere. Every time I have a conversation with her, she's in a new country, and this fascinates me. And you're right. It's one of the many things that I ask you that you don't have an answer for.
I think there's only 3 things you ask me I don't have an answer for. But today we have someone here to help us out with that.
We do. I am super excited. We have been trying to talk to Alessandro Polidoro for a while now, since before the conference last fall. And part of why we've been wanting to talk to him is because what he does is so cool and so niche. He is the lead attorney of litigation and digital rights advocacy for Stop Data Porn. He's been coordinating an effort around Europe's new regulations, the Digital Services Act, to build a coalition to protect people. And he is a sailor. I love the ocean. And he's a Dungeons and Dragons DM, which, I mean, I love therapeutic gaming. So everything about Alessandro has made me so excited to talk to him. And I am super excited that we finally have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Nice to be here.
First question is simple. Can you explain things better than my husband does?
Ouch.
Well, as a lawyer, I think I should respond, it depends. No, but I'm getting to the well, there were many questions there, so I'll try to cover all of them quite simply. You were mentioning the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR. This is a regulation that has come into force now 6 years ago, and it is a clear example of what we like to call in Europe the Brussels effect. So a regulation that started in Europe, a legal framework that was designed within the EU, and then kind of spearheaded a trend. It set a new standard for the whole world, and we've seen it also in the US. For instance, the California Consumer Privacy Act has been written using the GDPR as a blueprint. Similar pieces of legislation have also spawned in Brazil and other parts of the world. And basically, what is the probably the most relevant part of the GDPR on a global scale is that because of this concept of the extraterritorial effect of the GDPR, it's enforceable also outside of the EU, because all the subjects that are doing business with Europe or that basically are processing personal data of residents or citizens of the European Union have to comply with the GDPR. And this is probably the reason why it was so groundbreaking when it came out, and especially in the field of pornography, of the adult entertainment industry, it has tried to set standards that my colleagues and I, we have realized are not actually followed as they should be. So this is probably what was the starting point for us. When we decided to run the litigation that you mentioned, this project called Stop Data Porn, It was actually to try and bring accountability and possibly enforcement of this regulation that it's so important for the protection of users, of citizens, but it's oftentimes ignored, especially in the pornography field.
Yeah, and I'd like to think that whatever pornography we may be viewing in the late at night or in our time alone is private, right? That the data is not being collected, it's not being aggregated. And I know there is under GDPR the right to be forgotten. I would just like every day on a porn site, just forget me. Like, I'm done now. Forget everything I just did. But it doesn't seem to be the case. I guess they're collecting a lot more data than I thought or anticipated.
Right, right. I mean, that's absolutely true what you said. And everybody is expecting a certain level of intimacy when dealing with this kind of content. At least, I mean, most of the time, I would assume. And the opposite is true, unfortunately. And the funniest part, you know, is that this topic of profiling users and understanding the sexual preferences, it's something that some platforms, for instance, Pornhub, have never been shy about. You know, because if you think of Pornhub, as I was saying, there is at the end of every year, they do the very famous earring review where they say, oh, look, it's a brilliant strategy of marketing that they go and say, oh, look, in this part of the world, they like this kind of porn. And in this part of the world, they prefer these other things. And so they actually state very clearly that they know all the preferences in terms of pornography of their users. But then when you ask them to tell the same stuff in a legal scenario, in a legal context, all of a sudden they become quite elusive, and it's surprising. Our litigation started exactly with that. We, thanks to the contribution of some volunteers, we were able to file a series of data subject access requests to the platform. Pornhub was the case study for the litigation. We were asking, what data do you have about us? These users, they were saying, you know, I've been using your platform for a while. What do you know about me? And they replied, we only know your email if you gave it to us and a few others, other things. I mean, they basically pretend they could have been selling cheese. They could have been doing any other business, you know, and this was quite shocking to begin with. This is, of course, I don't know if this is something that can be very concerning for everybody, but the part that scares me personally the most is that also this profiling happens automatically. You know, today everybody talks about AI, but before that we were talking about algorithms and it's kind of a similar subject. And this kind of profiling algorithms, these personalization algorithms, they simply check the way you use the platform and then they assign you a sexual preference. So this is for me the part that is most scary. It's not simply that they know or they assume to know what we like in terms of pornography, but it's that this is assigned by a machine. A machine that doesn't communicate it transparently, so you don't know which sexual preference has been assigned to you by the machine, and it's impossible to challenge. And yeah, it's all just very scary.
And that I find particularly fascinating because there is a huge trend of straight women enjoying gay male erotica. I have a friend who makes her living as a bisexual woman writing MLM romance novels and erotica. Like that's all she does. And she has a huge audience of mostly cis straight women. And the same is true, we know, with porn, that a lot of straight women like watching gay porn. So the idea that there's, you know, an algorithm or a program somewhere that's looking at your search history and trying to pin you down into a specific sexuality box is really problematic because human behavior doesn't fit so nicely into algorithms.
Absolutely. Also, I adding on what you just said, what happens when there is a data leak? what happens when this list of preferences is disclosed for whatever reason? And I mentioned data leak because I want to be optimistic that these lists are not just simply traded around in a form that maybe still allows somebody to trace back an individual from what usually are supposed to be aggregated, anonymized, huge data sets. Especially these days, we know that there can be political groups with discriminatory agendas that would really make harmful use of this kind of information, right? And this is the reason that so to be a bit clearer, the litigation that we started and the complaints that we filed, we filed them in two different places, in Europe, in Italy and in Cyprus. We started in Italy because this is where the organization that I've been working with was located, and we were counting on some volunteers that were based in Italy in the beginning. But soon enough, we realized that we had to bring the litigation also in Cyprus. And the reason of that is, I always make this joke that usually the bigger the company, the smaller the island. And that's the case also for Pornhub, because the huge conglomerate that controls Pornhub as a satellite company in Cyprus that used to be called MG Freesites Limited, and MG used to mean MindGeek. But now, as we know, MindGeek changed their name into ILO, and so now it's called ILO Freesites Limited. And so as I was saying, we filed the complaint in Cyprus as well, because we needed to trigger the action of what the GDPR calls the lead authority, the lead data protection authority, that is basically responsible for enforcing this regulation against the data controller, against the platform that is actually responsible for the processing of personal data. And this was already very interesting because it allowed us to see how different bodies of different nations within the European Union try and cooperate on these kind of issues. The litigation is still ongoing, so it's probably soon to say what will be the final outcome of it. But I can say that on both sides we've had really interesting and positive feedbacks, and the work done by the data protection authorities involved is being quite remarkable.
I want to pull on something because I don't know that's immediately obvious to people. But if you're going to these websites, your thought may be, well, I'm sure they track some things, but it's anonymous, right? It's just anonymous. I haven't given them my email address, to your point earlier. I haven't logged into one of these sites and started browsing or things around. One of the things I think many people don't realize or forget is that there's a number of different techniques to de-anonymize data, right? Be it based on where you're at, based on the times you log in, based on the unique fingerprint of your device, based on, I've even seen de-anonymizer papers where they look at, they cross-reference the anonymized data set with like travel patterns. Like, oh, this is your normal behavior and you were in, I'm in Detroit now. You're in Detroit, and then, you know, on this particular date, you were in Cyprus. So therefore, because the behavior is the same and we have, you know, looked at your travel plans, we can say with a degree of assurance that is you. I've got to imagine, even though it's anonymized data, that a lot of these same techniques are available on these content providers, right?
This is absolutely correct. I believe there was also an episode of the show from by the John Oliver shows Last Week Tonight. Yeah, I think so. They made at some point an episode about data brokers, and I think that they were playing with the ability of tracing back individuals from huge anonymized data sets. And the funny thing is that John Oliver was able to trace back, I think, 5 members of the US Congress. If I can give a suggestion to our audience, you should totally check it out. I think it's available on YouTube. It's a very insightful episode of the show. So to give an answer to what you were saying, of course, there are all these many other data that can be cross-referenced and allow eventually to take a person out of a bunch of data. Because, of course, let me be the lawyer in the room again here. So the GDPR is very clear on what a personal data is. A personal data is not only a data that makes a person identified, but also a data that makes a person identifiable. So this means that when you have this piece of information, maybe you don't know yet who this person is, but you can use this one and a few others and then understand who this person is. So a few techniques that we were able to document that are happening on Pornhub, or at least we were quite confident to see, techniques of device fingerprinting or browser fingerprinting, of hardware fingerprinting, which basically means that when you cross-reference the IP of a person, the model of a device that they were using to connect, the time of the day, and many other factors that are simply extracted by the machine that are used, by the technicalities of accessing to internet. And you can quite easily then narrow all these informations down to one single person, because when you have all these elements, how many people were actually connecting from that specific area of the world at that specific time with that specific computer. And you know, also the other thing that you mentioned, the fact that probably 90% of the users, and now I'm just throwing a number here, but you know, it was to give like the majority of the users, they don't even have an account on these platforms, right? And of course, if you have an account, then they track your history. But what we were able to document, and this time this was also replicated by a journalist at Wired, Wired.com, they made a brilliant article when we launched the campaign, and they were so scrupulous and careful also to replicate our methodologies of investigation. What they did document, the same way we did beforehand, was that when you are not registered to the platform and you access to it, the browser that you are using is requested by the servers on of Pornhub to store some lines of numbers, some codes that are unique identifiers of the specific video that you have watched, and these identifiers are stored in the local storage of your browser. So it's a specific part of the browser, of the memory of your browser, that doesn't even get cleared when you reset the cookies. So you know, the classic meme gesture of just, you know, cleaning your history or clearing your cookies, it would not remove this. It's a parallel history of your what you've watched on Pornhub, and it's just there.
Is there a way for people to access online content without giving up their information? Is something like a VPN a protector in situations like this, or is it just a case of the old adage, you know, if the product is free, you're the product?
Well, I've said this very same sentence many times. When the product is free, you are the product. And this is absolutely the point. Honestly, I don't think it would be responsible for me to answer directly to your question, because I don't want to give the sense of the false sense of safety to users. Of course, there are ways. If you're a tech savvy, you can always find a way to try and be almost impossible to be tracked and whatnot. But the truth of the matter is that the average user is becoming more and more difficult. And actually, the reason why I'd rather not give this false sense of safety is because there is an issue connected to what you've just said. Like, what is our agency? What is our possibility? What space is left to our possibility to still do what we want to do in these spaces without being compromised? Well, I think it's quite telling to consider that the very first claim of our litigation, the very first pillar of what we wanted to say in our complaints, was the issue of consent. Because I think that the issue of consent is strictly connected with the issue of agency and the issue of safety in a way, like feeling safe when you're navigating online. The first point we made in our litigation is that Pornhub, and this is true for all the countries in Europe up until last June, they were never ever asking for consent when accessing the platform, for the cookies that they were using, for the tracking that they were doing, and for all the things that I've described before. This is something that is quite surprising, especially for an average European user, because especially since the GDPR came out, but the consent for cookies is something that was required even before the GDPR came into force. As I was saying, the consent for cookies is something that we see everywhere, like YouTube, for instance. I sometimes listen to music on YouTube, right? And every time that you open YouTube from a new device, from a new browser, they say, do you consent to cookies? And at the end of the day, I listen to music there, and they know what's my favorite Bob Dylan album, for instance. But when I go on Pornhub, they know what I like to watch when I'm, you know, spending some time by myself or in company. It really depends. And in this case, it was crazy that they were not asking for consent. Any other business was already doing it for so long, and they're such a big platform. And this is so true that as we published the litigation and as we got some very good coverage from the media, they changed their own page in less than 2 weeks. This famous button of consent was implemented on the home page of all European countries by Pornhub. So quickly, and at first the button was a bit too tiny, so we actually made a follow-up statement saying that this was clearly just a fake solution, just something, you know, to clear the consciousness and say, yeah, we did the less than the bare minimum, but at least we did something. And the funny thing is that when we said that it was too little, they changed it again in less than a week. And so now you have this very big button of consent on requires consent before accessing Pornhub. And the reason why they didn't do it before, in my opinion, it's but this is again just my opinion. It's quite simple, and the reason is traffic, because now that the button is there, there will be, statistically speaking, for sure somebody that will realize that maybe they can go somewhere else to bring their private business. You know, they can maybe get their content on a different platform rather than go to this tech giant and feed them with their intimate and personal data. And just to one closing remark on this, on the topic of consent. Okay, they did implement this button. They did implement this solution for the cookies, but this is absolutely not enough. Because the GDPR says that when you're tracking sensitive data, when you're collecting data related to, well, many issues, it can be your political beliefs, your religion, or in this case, your sexual life, you need to ask for a very explicit consent because you're processing explicit data. And this is when the paradox that I mentioned before becomes even more visible, because still today, if you ask Pornhub in a legal context, hey, are you processing legal sexual preferences of people? They're going to say no. Their privacy policy today doesn't specify that at all, even though every year, in their yearly review, in their marketing campaigns, they go around and say, oh, yeah, no, we know what you like. We know who likes to watch MILF videos. We know who likes to watch group sex. We know who likes to watch gay porn or straight stuff, you know, all these kind of things. So it's quite ridiculous. It's hidden in plain sight, basically. It's not even that well.
I would love to hear more about how your coalition is addressing this, right? We've been talking a lot about what it looks like and what the issues are, and I've been asking you all my questions my husband can't answer. Before we go too much further, I mean, talk to us about what steps you're taking to push back on this. Talk to us about who you're working with and how you guys are tackling this in order to preserve privacy for European users, because goodness knows in America, we're just left to the wind.
Well, I mean, never say never, because the litigation that we're doing is absolutely replicable in the US. So actually, for our listeners out there, if you're a lawyer and you're based in California, hit me up. Anyway, what happened after the litigation was launched was actually very, very impressive, because first of all, well, I had a roadmap of what I thought was going to happen. I was talking with my team back then in June last summer, and I was like, yeah, I think we will be able to have a certain impact, and I think that a few things will actually happen and we will be able to be proud of this. And, you know, it's legal stuff. It takes time. It's not that fast. It's going to take 1.5 years. Everything happened in 3 weeks. everything that we wanted to happen happened in 3 weeks. We got immediate response from the Italian Data Protection Authority, and then a very significant response from the platforms itself, for the platform itself. And most importantly, what happened was that really the people, both experts and just like everyday citizens, they all got very interested in this issue. And everything kind of snowballed into something even bigger that I would have never thought before. Because, you know, now in Europe, there is this new regulation that has come into force, which is called the Digital Services Act. And the idea for us was to understand how we could leverage it in the porn industry, in the adult entertainment industry, and use it against not only Pornhub in this case at this point, but all the biggest porn giants, the tech giants in porn. And of course, it is something that required a completely different approach. We weren't actually able to do it on our own. It would not have been meaningful to push it on behalf of one specific organization. So what happened was that all these other groups and organizations, some of the big names of the digital rights scene, especially maybe some of the listeners would be familiar with organizations like Access Now, or European Digital Rights is also a huge network of NGOs in this field. There was a CDT, Center for Democracy and Technology, and many other groups. I think the one that was dearest for me was the contribution coming from a network that is called European Sex Workers Alliance, and they are not only defending the rights of sex workers, but also being more and more conscious and aware of the issues of the digital rights, and they are very active in the and vocal for the digital rights policies in Europe. So as I was saying, with all these groups, we went to the European Commission, the government of the European Union, and we basically just said, hey, this regulation is coming into force, and you should not forget porn platforms when you do that. When you enforce it, when you basically what they were doing was creating a list. The Digital Services Act as these specific articles that are only referred to the biggest platforms out there. The law calls it very large online platforms, and the European Commission last year started making a list of these very large online platforms. You can imagine all the big names, so Facebook, YouTube, TikTok. There is even Amazon, even though Amazon is currently challenging the designation as very large online platforms because apparently they claim not to be that big after all. And the problem is that in that list there was no porn platform. Even though if you check the ranking of the most visited websites in the world, Pornhub used to be the 12th most visited, now it's the 14th. Now, correlation is not causation, but it used to be the 12th before our litigation came out, and now it's the 14th, so they lost two positions. I don't know why, many reasons probably. Xvideos is the most visited porn platform in the world and ranks as the 10th or 11th most visited website in general. And they were not part of this list. So we kind of pushed a little bit and made our voice be heard on this topic. And surprisingly enough, once again, it took us 6 months, I believe, 7 months to arrange this campaign and publish an open letter. We got some coverage. And very quickly, we received a very reassuring reply from the European Commission that said that they were aware of the issue, that they were, doing the work necessary for this designation, and then they actually did designate three platforms in December, so a few months ago, Pornhub, Xvideos, and Stripchat were designated as the very first three very large online platforms in the porn sector in Europe, and now they will have to comply with many requirements of this regulation. They will have to allow independent auditors, so we will finally be able to open the black box of this algorithm. All this problem with the personalization of users that we've discussed until now, all this problem with not knowing how these the machines that are deployed by these tech giants work. We will finally be able to open this black box. Of course, if and only if they don't challenge the designation and they bring to court the European Commission. But this is a hot topic right now, and I think that even if they tried something like that, it would only delay the inevitable for them, because they have the numbers to be designated big platforms. And to close on this point, the reason why this regulation is targeting big platforms is because we have finally been able to recognize that platforms this big bring with their simple existence, for the simple fact that they exist, they bring a systemic risk to society. We've seen it a lot, you know. We've seen it with Facebook and the power of manipulating elections. We've seen it with YouTube and the possibility of spreading disinformation, you know, those very creepy rabbit holes that sometimes people can get lost into. And when it comes to porn platforms, there is a systemic risk when they get so big. And it's not only the simple fact of the way that their business is run and the fact that, as we have seen, oftentimes they just don't play by the rules. But also, if you put all these very sensitive content, all these very delicate information in one place, if you don't diversify, not only you are stuck, you block the development of a thriving industry. The sex acting industry suffers so much for the simple existence of these tech giants. But you're also creating very dangerous weapons, very dangerous tools. We've seen it recently with the deep fake of Taylor Swift, but there are so many other examples of gender-based violence that have been facilitated through porn platforms. And they need to be held accountable for that.
They absolutely need to be held accountable for that. One of the things that I really admire you for, and this gets back to your question, Stephanie, so I'm going to pick on you for a little bit. I think there's something intrinsic in the like American way of thinking sometimes, which is, okay, what do I need to do individually to protect myself? Right. And you could have spent all the time you spent going after Pornhub and not now all the work that you've done, going after, you know, making sure that within the European Digital Services Act that, you know, these companies are in scope. You could have spent that time just protecting yourself. And maybe you could have been very, you know, invisible to all these platforms. Maybe you could have come up with a great way of doing it. Maybe you could have shared that out and maybe another, you know, 5, 10 or 50 or 100 people might have followed that along. But by taking action at the level you're taking action, and just a couple weeks, you changed Pornhub. You changed the way that they're gathering information, right? In taking this action at the level you're taking it, I love it because it seems to me to protect a significant amount of people with the amount of time, right? The multiplier effect is very strong. So my hat's off to you for taking on these companies and taking on these laws. Before we wrap up, though, I wonder, like, where are we at in this story? Where are we at in the Stop Data Porn story? Where are we at in the Digital Services Act story? You know, what's happening today as we're recording this, and what do you see happening as we head into spring and summer?
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you so much for your words. Very kind, and I want to precise that it's always a team effort. I like to consider myself often always just a facilitator. Sometimes they when I'm asked to be a coordinator, maybe, but it is always important to realize that this kind of results, this kind of impact, can only be achieved when people get together. And this is I will get to that soon, because the coalition that we've built now, it's a clear example of that. But to answer to your question about the litigation, because that's also possibly the most exciting part, because lawsuits can be exciting, or at least for legal nerds like me, they are. As I was saying, we filed these two complaints, right? One in Italy and one in Cyprus. To be precise, the one in Cyprus happened earlier. And to be even more precise, we filed a report in Italy that didn't get any impact. Then we filed a complaint in Cyprus that also went a little bit, unnoticed. But this was probably our mistake, was a strategy that we used, because we thought if we just file the complaint and wait and try to establish a communication with data protection authority, we will use the benefit of surprise and the advantage of not having shared our action with the public, and maybe they will be able to go and check on the platform without them knowing that they're coming. And this is something that actually started happening, but in a way that we were not even informed of. So eventually we realized that the secret ingredient to make things moving was to be loud and to be vocal and to be a huge, scary bunch of angry people that are reclaiming their rights. And that's why last summer we decided to file this new complaint in Italy and go to the media and pair it with a strong communication campaign. And this is exactly what made the wheel running and put the spin to what we were doing. And I'm saying this because it's exactly what I wanted to say, is that actually it's important to have more and more people just to speak up and try to do what they can on these issues, because this is exactly what does the trick. So anyway, these two litigations now are hopefully in the point of merging together, because what happened is that in Italy, the DPA, the Data Protection Authority, asked Pornhub for clarification on the violations that were contested. And they hired a lawyer. The lawyer presented some some defense statements. We presented our counterarguments to the statement that they made. And now we are waiting for the Cyprus DPA to allow the Italian DPA to continue, because, as I said, it's the Cyprus DPA that is leading the proceeding and they will decide. What happened in Cyprus is that we have been informed very recently, few weeks ago, that a huge file has been opened by the Cyprus Data Protection Authority regarding Pornhub. Something that, according to what the Data Protection Authority said to some journalists a few weeks ago, goes even beyond the simple. The simple part that we were able to see from a user standpoint, because, you know, we could only see the outside of the platform and we could only represent the interests and the rights of the individuals protected by the GDPR. But the Data Protection Authority themselves, they have so many more tools. They have stronger power. They can, of course, use they can forcibly obtain access to documents and to other resources. So what is going on in Cyprus right now is that our complaint has been merged into this bigger investigation, this bigger audit that they have done, and the proceeding is starting now, possibly to issue a decision that will basically list all the violations that have been spotted. There will probably be a fine if Pornhub will not be able to justify the claims that have been raised against them. But as I said, everything is still happening. But it's getting closer to it. I could say that it's already in the second half. The game is already going to the second half. So we are getting closer to the end of it. And just to get back to this thing, because I can't stress that enough, it's very important to understand that the more the merrier, and the more we are, the stronger we can be. What happened with the movement that then came after the coalition based on the DSA is that right now we have this group, this network, this multi-stakeholder alliance that is putting together digital rights activists, sex workers' rights defenders, survivors of gender-based violence, builders of sex tech, which is, in my opinion, an amazing category, often underrepresented. Because of the problem that I was saying before, there are so many small but amazing projects that try to spread their wings and try to position themselves on the market, but it's very difficult for them to actually survive longer than 4 or 5 years, because as another very famous person in this field, Cindy Gallup, as Cindy Gallup would tell you, the industry is really underfunded, and it's very difficult to find people that have the vision to understand what has to happen. And so in the meantime, these few tech giants that often also represent not exactly the best portion of this industry are just there sitting on their strategic advantage, and they don't allow anything to thrive, anything new to grow and to just even have a fair chance to compete. And so this network right now, what we are trying to do is basically work exactly on that. We don't want to push necessarily for new regulation because we don't believe that the solution to the problems that we've talked today can come only from legal solution. Of course, we need new policy. We need new best practices. We need new guidelines. We need protection for the weak part of this ecosystem from these big sharks, of course. But at the same time, we also understand that the solution can come from other sides. So from other fields, some people would say that it comes from a technological standpoint. If we only would develop more open source software for this field, more decentralized platforms, or simply new technological solutions also to protect users from this. I mentioned gender-based violence, and this can totally be an issue. There is the big problem of image-based sexual abuse that is absolutely present on this platform. There is also there is a problem at the same time of the stigmatization of those who work in this field, and then the fact that sometimes when we try to change the platform, either technologically, so adding new technical requirements, or legally, so adding new steps, new loops to jump through. Most of the people that work in the field then get kicked out, and they basically have to give up. They lose the safety that they normally would enjoy taking advantage of this technology. So in the case of sex workers, for instance, they have to go back to the street. So it's very complex and convoluted. But the point that I want to make here is that the solution, the actual key to this whole issue, it must come from a cultural standpoint. It cannot be legal. Only legal, it cannot be technological or only technological. There must be a paradigm shift, a shift of paradigm in how we see intimacy, how we experience sexuality, and how we talk about it. And ultimately, this is also the reason why today we have the huge, huge problem that because we don't have a meaningful and serious access to sexual education, these porn tech giants have become the point of reference, especially for the younger generations. And so you see, a problem this big, that it's connected to a part that it's so important of everybody's life, can only be solved with the contribution of many, many people working together and coming from different directions, from different experiences. One thing that I always like to repeat, quoting the protesters of Hong Kong back then, some years ago, we're all climbing the same mountain. I always say that during the meetings of our coalition, because I like to state and repeat that sometimes we speak different languages, sometimes we are representing different interests, but we're all trying to probably unblock an important new stage for humanity. And I'm being a bit romantic here, but this is how much I believe in what we are doing in the coalition, because it would be unprecedented. If only we were able to have on a global scale a healthy conversation on sexuality, I think we would be able to see the difference in how the world goes immediately.
I love the fact that you bring up the culture shift piece, because as a sex therapist, as a sexologist, that's a huge part of the work that I do. That, you know, we can't heal sexual trauma, we can't build healthy sexual relationships unless we have a safe and positive culture around our bodies and around our sexuality. And I love the fact that you are trying to do that in a way that isn't saying ban all erotic material. What you're saying is make erotic material safe and positive. And that's exactly where I try to put my work. I know where our podcast is focused. And I so appreciate you carrying that message forward into litigation in this case.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much for tuning into Securing Sexuality, your source of information you need to protect yourselves and your relationships. And hopefully, at least today, at least on this episode, your source for the information to come along and climb this mountain with us.
Securing Sexuality is brought to you by the Bound Together Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit. From the bedroom to the cloud, we're here to help you navigate what safe sex looks like in a digital age.
Be sure to check out our website, securingsexuality.com, for links to more information about the topics we've discussed here today, as well as our live events.
And among those links will be a link to Stop Data Porn, because if you are that rare and elusive California attorney, Alessandra wants to hear from you. But until then, join us again for more fascinating conversations about the intersection of sexuality and technology. Have a great week, everyone.